17th, 2016. You're looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 554 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. I am Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. Whew, three podcasts this week. You know, back when this podcast started, we would do one a day. Now it's more than one a week wears me out. Getting old. Anyway, I thought there'd be no better way to remind us. I'm excited about the tournament starting today. You are excited about the tournament starting today. We're all excited about the tournament starting today. But it is worth noting that these players are essentially indentured servants, and they are not getting – we are all getting excited about all the Infinity ads coming in between the game and all the corporate champions. Maybe we're not excited about those things, but certainly they are a large part of our college basketball viewing experience. The corporate champions – the fact that you have to have a Gator, NCAA corporate sponsor, agreed upon logo, just all the junk that comes with it because CBS makes a bunch of money, the sort of thing that causes CBS to do a 2-hour selection show, which got them their just desserts when the bracket leaked. Anyway, the point is good to be reminded on this day that they're all terrible people because none of these players are getting paid. This does not mean you do not have to enjoy the game. It does not mean that there's something wrong with you for enjoying the game. I will enjoy all the games. I'm having a blast. But it's always good to keep in mind that these are indentured servants for big billionaire corporations and university presidents. So to talk to us about this today is Joe Nocera. He is the co-author of the book Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. His co-author is Ben Strauss. I actually reviewed this book for the New York Times, my first New York Times book review. I was very honored. I did not know Mr. Nocera when I reviewed the book, which is good because the New York Times actually asks you if you know the author, which is something, frankly, I feel like every place that review books should probably ask because, generally speaking, a lot of people that write letters and words and paragraphs tend to know one another. But point is, Joe Nocera is here. You can follow him on Twitter at Nocera, NocerayNYT. He's also a columnist writer for the New York Times. So please rate and review our podcast on iTunes. The music is by the Sundogs. And here is Joe Nocera. We'll be back next week to preview, I believe, the National League Central with Allison Futter. But for now, here is Joe Nocera. The podcast ends, by the way, with him just hanging up the phone. So you can go ahead and, you know, just cut. There's no goodbye message. Except for now, here's Joe. All right, hello, sir. First off, thank you for taking the time during a busy schedule. I wrote about the book for the New York Times, so you know how I feel about the book. And also, you have proof that I read it. So this is not like a lot of media interviews that you'll surely do. I'm curious, during this week when the tournament is happening, do you find, is there an extra level of – yeah, I imagine you're talking to a lot of people right now. It's probably the best way to put it. Do you like the NCAA tournament? Do you, as a fan of the sport, are you able to get into it, or are you unable to separate all kind of the grossness?
I've loved college basketball my whole life. I grew up in Providence, so I rooted for the Friars back when Jimmy Walker and John Thompson were playing for them. I mean, it's like, and I'm thrilled they're back in the tournament this year, by the way. So yeah, I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to root for it, but I know that the players are being exploited, and it doesn't ruin it for me, but, I wish it would change. And I've written this book in part to try and propel that change.
One of the things I always find interesting is the onus that's put on the athletes to invoke change in a lot of this. There always seems to be this. I know that a lot of activists sometimes will say, like, well, the players need to like sit down and not play, and that'll make change. Which I think may be true, is asking a lot. I think of a player to be in that situation. And I'm always curious. I was at the Jerry World diamond encrusted game 2 years ago when Shabazz Napier, after they won the game, who had talked about how he went to bed hungry and he tried to speak out while he had that megaphone. But I feel like people just moved on to the game itself. How do you break through, either as an athlete or from the people that you've worked with? How do you break through to continue to push change going, considering how much has been done in the last
right.
2 years?
Well, the change that's taken place is on the margins. I mean, it's not insignificant. Cost of attendance is something the NCAA actually fought in court saying it would ruin college sports, and now it's, of course, completely accepted. You know, four-year scholarships are coming back. You know, the health care is a little bit better. You know, so there's some stuff that's happening on the margins, but that doesn't change the sort of core issue that you know, the revenue sport players are not, you know, they're not getting the value for what they do. You know, they're not getting the education, they're not getting the money. They're really, you know, they're still being exploited. The courts have turned out to be sort of hopeless. They rule against the NCAA, and yet they're not willing to do anything as a result. We've learned that the National Labor Relations Board just throws up their hands and says we can't handle this. Congress is never going to do anything. So, you know, yeah, if the players could stand up for themselves the way the Missouri football team did last fall over the racial stuff, it would be a total game changer. But I totally understand why that's almost impossible to ask 18 and 19-year-old kids to do that. I actually think you could really affect change if some professional athletes would stand up. Arian Foster blurbed our book, as you may recall, and so did Kareem. You know, I had a talk, I had a long talk with Chris Paul a couple of weeks ago of the LA Clippers, and I was actually there to talk about Steve Ballmer. I was doing a column about the new owner of the Clippers, and so I got to meet Chris Paul, and I handed him the book, and that's all he wanted to talk about. You know, how hard it had been at Wake Forest, and how little money he'd had, and how exploited he felt when he saw the jerseys in the Wake Forest bookstore. And, you know, I think that professional athletes, especially African-American professional athletes, if they stood up and said, you know, what happens to these college players is wrong, and needs to change, I think that has the potential to be a game changer. Nobody's really thought about that or talked about that, but I think it has that potential.
One of the things that comes across very strongly in your book is just how the NCAA, while they may have started with good intentions, has become in many ways, regardless of just the enforcer of the rules, but almost a lobbying group in and of itself. They've become so powerful. Has there been a sense with the like your book and with the O'Bannon case and a lot of this pushback, is there a sense that they're getting more understanding of the issue of this, or are they digging their feet in more?
They're doing both, actually. You know, Mark Emmert thinks of himself as a reformer. Their big issue right now is the time demand on athletes. You know, they're only supposed to play, you're only supposed to practice or play 20 hours a week, but it's actually more like 50 or 60. So they are, you know, they're kind of aligned with the Power Five conferences in terms of trying to make things better for the athletes on the margins. But that also has a propaganda value to them, because they're trying to say, look, these players have a good deal. They're getting an education. Plus, we're doing this. Plus, we're doing this. Plus, we're doing this. And on the core issue, they are digging their heels in. I mean, they, you know, this thing called the collegiate model, this phrase.
Yes.
What it really means, it's a justification for professionalizing everything else about college sports, except the players have to be amateurs. So I don't know about you, Will, but I'm getting in my email these days invitations to play in the Capital One March Madness Bracket Challenge. So they even have a sponsor for brackets.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how professionalized this thing is. It's absurd. You can't bring a Pepsi, by the way, into the Houston arena, because Coca-Cola is the official sponsor, soft drink sponsor of the NCAA. So, you know, they're never going to change their view that the labor force should remain unpaid. And I would venture, you know, the plaintiffs in the O'Bannon case just petitioned the Supreme Court to hear the case. And I could bet you that if O'Bannon were to win at the Supreme Court, the NCAA would go to Congress and try and get an antitrust exemption. They're never going to change on the core position.
Is it, you know, one thing that you hear, and I wrote about in my review of your book, one thing you hear a lot from people who who don't want players they played or don't think this is as urgent. And among this, I'm not one of those people. But one thing you hear from them a lot is, all right, so how are you going to do it? Like, how are you going to do it? How can you fix this? Which to me seems a very strange defense of something that's clearly wrong. But
right.
But nevertheless, you know, has there been movements toward, like, you just wrote a whole book about this. Is there, what have you seen as at least the most realistic small step that could be made that's more than just cost of living increases?
Well, first of all, cost of living increases are actually getting pretty big. In Alabama, they're $6,000. They used to be two or three. There's no small step. Well, there's two things. First of all, there's the Olympic model. Okay, the Olympic model is actually great, and I would apply it not just to football and basketball players, but to everybody. Like, you know, if the star soccer player at the University of North Carolina, a woman soccer player, you know, they want to give her an endorsement, she should be able to get an endorsement. Autographs. All the Olympic model basically says you can't get paid for playing the actual game, but anything around it is fine. You know, money from sponsors, or money from endorsements, or, you know, I think that is one step that would be super easy to do. In the O'Bannon case, the district court judge said that there should be a $5,000 trust fund for players that they could get when they left school. I mean, I think that's a pathetic amount of money. And it also suggests that even though she says the NCAA has violated the antitrust law, she's still allowing them to set the compensation. She's just setting it a little bit higher. My idea is to have a salary cap, where every player would get a minimum salary of like $25,000 or $30,000, and you'd have half the cap left over, just as you do in the pros, to use it to attract players. To say to a high school halfback, you know, I'll pay you $40,000 a year to come to my school. We'll sign a 3-year contract. You can't leave till your junior year. Somebody else comes and say, I'll pay you I'm a lesser known school, but I'll pay you $50,000. And then you make a decision that's based in part, you know, it's about coaching and facilities, but it's also based on money. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Andy Schwartz and Dan Rasher, who are two economists who are central players in the book, who really came up with the intellectual backbone of what became the O'Bannon case, you know, they believe that the appropriate vehicle for setting compensation for athletes should be the conferences, and that the conferences should make their own decisions about how and how much to compensate athletes. You know, that already happens to a small extent in that, you know, some conferences now are giving 4-year scholarships. Some still have 1-year scholarships. The Ivies don't have athletic scholarships at all. So they have a different form of compensation. I think that would actually cause player pay to rise pretty quickly, but you know what? I'm okay with that.
One thing I'm curious, obviously you've obviously always followed sports, but this has really been you've covered all sorts of other topics. And, you know, I do some politics writing for Bloomberg in addition to this. And one thing I always find particularly curious about sports, it seems when, you know, you'll have what would seem a clear-cut legal issue in a lot of ways. And I noticed this from your book as well. It would get to a certain level of a judge, or it would get to a certain level of politician, and they would always end up going back to, yeah, but this guy loved sports. And it's very strange to me that I feel like it's part of this general national inability or unwillingness to accept that sports is business.
I make a distinction. So, you know, the universities in the 1980s sued the NCAA saying that it was an antitrust violation for the NCAA to have the television rights for college football. The universities won. The assistant coaches, do you remember this? There was a famous assistant coaches case in the 1990s where the NCAA tried to set their pay at like $16,000. And again, they sued for antitrust violations and restraint of trade, and they won. Of course they won. It's the most obvious restraint of trade in the world. But when it comes to dealing with 18, 19, 20-year-old kids, many of whom are poor and black, the court system and other people in power don't take the same, you know, logical mindset and say, well, if it's an antitrust violation to restrict the pay of assistant coaches, Why is it not an antitrust violation to restrict the pay of the players? Why is that? They don't do that. Instead, they say, oh, you know, we have this great system that gives them an education and competitive balance and yada, yada, yada. And then they just punt.
It does seem strange to me. You know, you can even see from the back of your book the number of pretty high profile people that understand that this fundamental inequity and this fundamental just frankly insanity that all this money is being the corporate champions the NCAA none of it going to players, and it feels like it's broken through in mainstream discourse. It feels like the fact that Jay Billis is one of the two or three most prominent college basketball commentators in the country and is an active proponent of, like, he's not just someone that quietly supports, he's an active proponent of some of the things we're talking about here. Why do you think it's not broken through? Like, it seems strange to me that, like, is NCAA that powerful, or is there something overarching with the universities or with the university? Is it the fact that colleges are short on money? Like, what's actually holding back? Because it seems to be the mainstream conversation on this, if not necessarily settled, at least has grown to a point where everybody understands it.
Well, I think among the universities, the NCAA, the conferences, you know, they like the system the way it is. It generates lots of money for them, and it really enriches a lot of them. So they have a total vested interest in the status quo. And they can argue all they want that this is good for the athletes, and that's why they're doing it, and yada, yada, yada. But their self-interest is so palpable that, you know, it's pretty easy to see that that is what's driving them. The fans are a little different. I would say that a lot of fans just like the things the way they are. And they, you know, if you're somebody who is struggling to put your kid through college and, you know, college costs $50,000 a year, and you see these athletes getting a free ride, so that's worth, you know, $200,000 a year, you're thinking to yourself, boy, that guy's pretty lucky. You know, he's got a good deal. And there's some resentment that he would want to make more money. Just as there was resentment among the fans when Major League Baseball, when Marvin Miller was trying to get a free agency for Major League Baseball. And the fan, a lot of fans just resented this and said they make enough money and they, you know, they're greedy and so on and so forth. So it, to me, that's kind of very similar. The truth is that the set of ideas that I'm putting forth and the set of ideas that are being put forth by the major characters in my book are never going to be completely popular mainstream ideas. It's never going to be a case like marriage equality, for instance, where the country thinks one thing, 70% against, you know, gay marriage, and then 10 years later, 70% of the country is in favor of gay marriage. That's never going to happen here. And what's going to happen instead, if change takes place, is that it's going to be driven by court rulings or players standing up for themselves or, you know, black athletes trying to turn this into a racial issue and kind of shaming the NCAA and universities into change. But it's never going to be because the fans have come around to the idea that the players should be paid or should be treated better.
All right. Well, sir, I appreciate your time. As you know, as is literally in the public record, not in the public record, but yes, certainly in the paper of record, you know I'm a big fan of the book. So I appreciate your time. The book is Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA by Joan O'Sara and Ben Strauss. Sir, continue good luck with the book. Thank you for your time. And in spite of it all, good luck to the Friars.
Yeah, well, they got a tough second round. We'll see what happens. Anyway, thanks so much.
Of course. Be safe. Thank you.